Okay, good evening, everyone. Are we going to begin? Welcome to another Kabbalah series. We haven't done one for a while. And this week and next week, and this time we've entitled it The Kabbalah of Food. I remember as a child in Johannesburg, we had, from time to time, we had different guests for Shabbat. And every so often, there was a gentleman who came from Israel. And he was always a guest at our house. Every year, he used to come. And he was a person that he certainly liked to eat, as we should say. And he would always make jokes. He would laugh at himself. He had a great sense of humor. So I remember him saying, and then that he used to make these little jokes here and there. And once he told us that he's on a diet at the moment. He said, "What kind of diet? Special diet. What kind of diet?" He says, "A diet that he only eats things that start with the letter Aleph." So he said, "What does that mean?" He said, like something like ashtikel fish, ashtikel flesh, ashtikel. Everything's Aleph. Ashtikel this, ashtikel that. Anything that starts with, he only eats things that start with the Aleph. So, we Jews have a bit of an obsession with food. Every yontif, every chag, every festival is connected with a food. Always. If it's Purim coming up, it's Homan Tashin, of course, Pesach, Matzis, other people who are very into Knedlach and other things, Shavuot, we have cheesecake. Rosh Hashanah, we have round challah, apple and honey. Even Yom Kippur, which is a day of fasting. So, of course, we eat the day before. Special kind of foods. We have honey cake and kreplach and all kinds of things. Sukkot, of course, the whole festival is about eating in the sukkah. And so on. So we seem to be very involved with food. Of course, we know that the Jewish mother's fear in making Shabbat and preparing food for people is always an anxiety that people might leave their home starving, which explains these sort of 14 salads and different courses that we have and things like that. And the truth is, as we know, that it's not always so good, meaning it's not always so healthy. I mean, Jewish food is not always the healthiest food. For example, schmaltz herring is not that healthy, in excess particularly. A four-course meal on Shabbat with cholent and all kinds of interesting food is always not that healthy necessarily. So what is our story? What's the story with food and how should we approach it? Now the truth is, not only these customs that I mentioned about the different foods that we have on Shabbat and so on, but the truth is that if you look in the Torah, a lot of the Torah's laws have to do with eating. Kashrut, for example, takes up a large portion of the Torah's laws. Things like what meat you can eat, what meat you can't eat, how meat must be prepared. Very complex laws in the code of Jewish law, which fish are kosher, which fish are not kosher, which birds are kosher, which birds are not kosher. A large part of the section of the Torah during temple times was about the laws of korbanot, which is sacrifices, but particularly about eating sacrifices. The laws of eating in the sukkah, the laws of what we have to eat on Pesach, the laws of the meals of Shabbat, they all have these types of laws. And secondly, we find a very fascinating thing in the Torah generally. In the Torah we find the term kedoshim, to be holy. The Torah encourages holiness, right? That's a phenomenon in the Torah we find, that generally the Torah encourages us to be holy. Now you would imagine that when the Torah encourages us to be holy, it's talking about things which we would associate naturally and logically with the concept of holiness, prayer, Torah learning, mitzvot. And yet what's fascinating is that in the Torah itself, in the Chumash, in the writings of the Chumash, the term holiness appears with emphasis in two areas. Food, eating. Whenever we have laws of eating, the Torah says it's associated with being holy. And the second is sexuality. The Torah gives the laws of sexuality, the laws of who we may marry, who we may not marry, good relationships, not good relationships, and so on. We find the word kedusha, which is quite phenomenal. In other words, we find the word for holiness, particularly not in the spiritual, although spiritual is very holy, of course. We find it specifically in areas of physicality and things that are most physical, One of them being food, one of them being eating. So what does this all mean and how does it work? So before we delve into a sort of a deeper Kabbalistic idea, let me just begin as an introduction with a sort of an obvious but important concept. And the obvious but important concept is that the more powerful something is, the more destructive it could be. Right? That's very simple. If you have something which is a machine of very, very high electrical voltage, it has the capacity to harm and to injure in a very destructive way, but probably then it can do much more than just a low voltage machine. So something that is very powerful can build, can cut things to size in order to construct huge buildings and so on and so forth, but it can also be more destructive, more destroying, right? And obviously when you have something that is very powerful, the positive application of whatever it is comes from two things. Comes from paying attention when you use it, using it safely. So a very, very, very high-powered and high electrical voltage machine needs special care. And it cannot be used indiscriminately. It needs to be used with a particular reason. It needs to be used in a particular way. And only then does it have the power, the positive power, that it was intended to have from the beginning. And the same thing is true with food, or by extension, general engagement with the physical. In the Jewish religion, engagement with the physical is extremely powerful. We are not a religion of abstinence as an end in itself. We do that, of course, sometimes temporarily, but although we have fast days, and although we have times that we're supposed to control ourselves, but it's not the end in itself. The end game, the end goal, is actually engagement with the physical, right, generally speaking. But food is like that powerful machine. Food is something that when we pursue eating, simply said, although we all do it to some degree, but when we pursue eating only for the purposes of pleasure and indulgence, then actually, spiritually speaking, particularly, but even physically really, if health-wise, but particularly spiritually, it becomes a destructive force. However, if we use it properly, in other words, its real benefit is when it's used with a specific focus, when it's what we call value-based eating, when it's done as a mitzvah, when it's done for a particular intention, when it's done for good reason and in the right way, then it becomes something which is incredibly powerful and incredibly elevating, as we'll soon see, we'll soon explain. Now, interestingly enough, we know that the very, very first transgression or failure in the story of humankind, as told in the Torah, at the beginning of Genesis, the beginning of Bereshit, is the story of eating the forbidden fruit, the Chet Eitz Hadat, the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge that Adam and Eve ate from the fruit of that tree. And really, what we learn later is, what we learn in the commentary, is that what they ate actually was going to become permissible hours later when Shabbat would arrive. According to many opinions, in fact, the forbidden fruit was a grape, and which is one of the reasons we make Kiddush on Friday night, to fix that sin of the grape that was eaten incorrectly. But essentially, the eating of the fruit that took place in the Garden of Eden was one of lack of self-control. That's the first failure. In other words, it was the pursuit of pleasure. They said they saw the fruit, kitovu, it looked good, it looked sweet, it looked like something that was delicious, and they went for it. Not reflecting, is it the right time to eat, or is it the right context? Or we're doing it for the right reason. Later on, when Shabbat would arrive, there would have been a context and a purpose of eating that fruit, we are taught by the commentators. And yet at that time there wasn't, and therefore they sinned. And that sin brought an effect, an impure, negative effect to the world from which we still suffer today. And the world will still be affected by it, we are taught, until the coming of Mashiach. So that's the principle behind what we're going to explain. Now, this is in 2 weeks, so what we're going to do today is we're going to talk in general. We're going to explain the Kabbalah of eating in general terms, and then next week we'll delve into hopefully some specific foods and what they mean Kabbalistically. Wine, we do it in various aspects of Judaism, we have wine, particularly on Purim, matzah on Pesach, and other things that we eat specifically which all have very, very deep and mystical meanings and significance, and hopefully we'll try and understand that next week. But today we're going to just talk about a general principle. Along the way or towards the end, if anyone has any questions, please don't hesitate. Just for now, put them in the chat, and we'll certainly try and go into them. Okay. So let's begin with a Kabbalistic idea about food. We are taught in the Talmud, we are taught in Jewish literature, that the world is divided into four parts. Domem, Tzomeach, Chai, and Medaber. Things that are inanimate and silent, like stones, rocks, minerals. Tzomeach, things that grow, grass, trees, vegetables, vegetation. Chai, the animal kingdom. And Medaber, the communicator, being the human being. This is in order of ascension. We are taught that the lowest form of creation, spiritually speaking, from a godly point of view, is the inanimate. That's why even in the physical sense, it's silent. It doesn't express a soul. It has a soul. Everything has a soul. But yet, the energy, the vibrancy in the domem, in the inanimate, is silent. Someach, things that grow, are really show signs of life and therefore signs of the divine energy, more spiritual. The animal kingdom is higher than vegetation, and the highest form of creation is the human being. I know in some ways of thinking nowadays that's not true. People are equal to animals. From a Jewish point of view, that is simply incorrect. We have to treat animals well, but it's not the same as a human being. The universe centers around the human being. The purpose of creation is around the human being. Having said that, however, what we do find is that the human being cannot exist without the sustenance from those things that are lower than the human being, so to speak. We cannot exist unless we eat. Eating comes from things that grow in the ground, in the inanimate, or from those things that are part of the animal kingdom, be it meat, be it fish, be it poultry. And that's the way the design of the human being is. Now, I don't know the physical and biological or medical reason why a person cannot exist without food and drink. I know if you don't drink, you get very dehydrated, and if you don't eat for a long period of time, that's problematic. But we know that everything that happens in the physical is because it has a source in the spiritual. And we need to understand what is the deeper reason, what is the depth of this concept that the human being, which is supposed to be the purpose of creation, which, by the way, it's why the human being was created last, because the world is a tool of the human being. The world around us is supposed to be something which we use in order to fulfill the mission of creation. But it's us, it's the human being, which is entrusted with the mission of fulfilling the purpose of creation. So we need to understand, why is it that God designed the human being in such a way that the human being cannot exist without ingesting something from the world around us, which is in fact, on a spiritual, godly level, lower than the human being itself. So a hint to this concept is a verse that is in Deuteronomy, in Dvarim. I didn't make a handout for tonight or a paper, but I'll just quote it for you. The verse that tells us, it's in fact in Deuteronomy, around the portion where it talks about Birkat HaMazon, when we say the blessings after we eat, and so on and so forth. And it says, Ki lo ala lechem levado yichyeh ha'adam. Not on bread alone can a person exist. Ki al kol motza pi Hashem, but rather on the utterance of the mouth of God. Now, in a very simple way, in a very simple reading of that verse, what the Torah is trying to tell us is that we shouldn't think we can exist ultimately only on physical food, but we need to connect to the Word of God, we need to learn Torah, we need to have a spiritual and divine connection. Food alone just won't do it. That's the simple meaning of this verse. But in Kabbalah, we learn that there's a deeper meaning of this verse, and that is like this. That a person does not live on the food only, When we eat food, we don't only exist and we are not only sustained because of the physical food that we're eating. But what is happening when we eat, we are ingesting not just the food, but the spark of God, the word of God that is in the food. In other words, every food has a nitzutz, has a spark of godliness, which when we eat the food, we not only are eating the physical food, but we are absorbing the godly spark that was in the food, and it's that godly spark which gives sustenance to the human being. So that sheds a little bit of light on what it means, why we need to eat in order to exist, but it doesn't really answer the question. And the reason it doesn't answer the question is, what do we mean by this concept that the spark of God is in the food and that's what sustains us? We also have a spark of God. We have a soul, a godly soul. We have a soul that has a spark of God. In fact, the concept here is that everything has a spark of God because everything has a soul. Everything has a divine spark. One of the fundamentals of Hasidic philosophy is the concept that God did not just create the world in the 6 days of creation and then let it run on its own, but God uttered the 10 utterances with which he created the world. Let there be water, let there be light, and so on and so forth. And those utterances of God, right? Those utterances of God is what is in every physical being, keeping it alive. But that includes the human being. So therefore, the obvious question is, it's all very nice to say that when we eat, it's not only the physical food that is sustaining us, but it's the spark of godliness within this physical food that is sustaining us. But why do we need that spark? If that spark is more hidden, so to speak, on a lower level than the godly spark that we contain, then why shouldn't the godly spark within us be enough to sustain us? Why do we need the food to sustain us? So to understand this concept, we need to go deeper and understand a whole Kabbalistic process here. So before I explain you this is the concept of the world of chaos, the world of Tohu, that's the way it's written in Kabbalah, and the world of Tikkun. We have what's called the world of chaos and the world of order. So fasten your seatbelts here and relax and stay with me on the journey. So first of all, where do we find this reference to chaos? At the very beginning of Genesis. So we're going to take a journey here off the topic and then come back and apply it to food. At the very beginning of Genesis, we are taught that Bereshit bara Elokim, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. But we have reference to Ha'aretz Haita Tohu Vavohu. The earth, that the world, the universe, existence was chaotic and empty. But just focus on the word chaos for a moment. Nothing was created yet. And then Vayomer Elokim Hior, God said, let there be light. The commentators ask a question. Why was light created first? Light is something you need when something else exists already. In other words, if you have a room which has a chair, has a table, has things you could use and you can't see, it's dark, you need a light. If a room is empty and dysfunctional, you cannot use it at all, there's no point in the light. So we would imagine that God should first create a world and then create light so we can see in the world. Why was light created first? And the answer they give is because light is the mission statement of the world. In other words, God tells us there's a world of chaos. There's an energy of chaos. Your job is to sort it out. Your job is to transform it into something productive. Your job is to transform it into something which will be a source of godly revelation. Your job is to transform the darkness, the chaos, into something beneficial. Now, what does all that mean? So, in Kabbalah we learn, I'm going to tell you something we learn in Kabbalah. I'll tell it to you first the way it is, which sounds very cryptic and complicated, and then break it down. Kabbalah teaches us that the world, as we know it, is what we call the world of Tikkun, the world of order. However, preceding this world, or transcending this world, is a world of Tohu, a world of chaos. Why is it called the world of chaos? Because it's a world which contained very intense, very powerful godly energy, which could not be contained properly. And when I say it could not be contained properly, that's related to a Kabbalistic idea of Or and Keli. In other words, like this. God has emanations, God has light that he creates, and those lights are manifested through a particular, what we call a Keli, a vessel, which contains it, channels it, and delivers it into our world. But in the world of Tohu, is what we call Orot Merubim, the light, the energy was intense, powerful, the Kelim Mu'atim, and very difficult to contain. And what happened was, because it was difficult to contain, again, I'm just telling you what the Kabbalah says, then we're going to break it down. It could not be revealed and delivered in an orderly fashion, so we have what we call in Kabbalah, Shvirat HaKelim. Shvirat HaKelim means the vessels explode, and the sparks of godliness fall down into something very low. Because they cannot be manifested, they cannot be revealed, they cannot be accessed in a normal, orderly way. And therefore, we are taught that in the lower forms of existence, in this world, in the world we have, in the lower forms, specifically in the lower forms of existence, lies powerful sparks of godliness from the world of chaos. But that world of chaos is actually a higher world than the world of Tikkun. It's a more intense world. It's a greater world, it's a loftier world. And yet, that world could not exist because of its intensity, and therefore explodes, and the sparks from that world fall and are actually found in the lower forms of existence. Now, the purpose of creation is the world of tikkun. The purpose of creation is the world of order. Because in our world, we're supposed to have order, we're supposed to have maturity, we're supposed to have rationale, we're supposed to have thought-out decisions, we're supposed to make decisions and guide ourselves in an orderly, mature way in order to live a life of purpose and meaning. But in this world, specifically in the lower forms of the world, there is found a greater energy, a powerful energy which originates from a higher source, the world of chaos. And it's up to us to release those sparks, to reveal them and absorb them into the world of order, and through doing that, elevate the world of order. Now, that all sounds very cryptic. Let me give you a bit of an analogy so you can understand this. An analogy for where we find the world of chaos in our human world is a child. You ever thought of that? A child has very intense energy. Most children, most kids are really very, very powerfully energetic. But it's a very sort of chaotic energy. It's not mature. It's all over the place. It goes from one extreme to another. It's the world of emotions, where emotions are not guided. They're not settled. They're not orderly at all. Two children, for example, just to give you an example, you can have two children that could end up in a massive fight, wanting to kill each other, and 3 minutes later, they're best of friends. You can have a child that can throw a tantrum 1 minute, show extreme anger and hate 1 second, and extreme love and affection the next minute. It's a chaotic world, a world of chaotic emotions. Very hard to integrate one emotion with another. Very hard to create balance. Very hard to find any stability and maturity in the world of a child, a very young child. And everything is expressed in just extremes, in a chaotic way, in an intense way. But it's a very intense energy. And the truth is that it's very beautiful in a way. There's a certain greatness in a child. Passion. A child has passion that often adults lose. A child has a sincerity, a purity, a truth about them, an undiluted truth that is so amazingly powerful. But as a child, in a childlike fashion, it's expressed in a very chaotic way. Now, what often happens, a child begins to grow. Maturity hopefully sets in. The ability to think, the ability to put things in order, the ability to make decisions, the ability to integrate one emotion with another, the ability to find when it's appropriate to have love, when it's appropriate to have hate, when it's appropriate to be kind, when it's appropriate to be harsh. Sometimes the combination of both, the harmony, the synthesis, right? And hopefully, as an adult matures, if they mature properly, they learn to manage all of these emotions. Now, two things can happen when a person becomes a child, and we find that happening. Two things can happen. One thing that can happen when a child matures, they become an adult, they eliminate the intensity and the power of the child. But that's wrong. We know we all have the child within us, and what we need to try and do is hang on to the energy and the chaos of a child, just guide it, stabilize it, and sustain it. In other words, when the art of becoming mature is not to eliminate the childlike energy, the art of becoming mature is to absorb and become strengthened and become more powerful by the childlike energy. Often we have a second chance at this when we have our own children of our own. Right? Or we're suddenly on the floor again playing games with children and sort of engaging in childlike energy. That's another opportunity, if we haven't done it till now, to sort of absorb that childlike energy. Become a bit of a child ourselves, but in an appropriate way. In a more mature way, but to still hang on and to still take the benefit from that chaotic and childlike beauty which is found in a child, in a very young child, but in a chaotic way, and to let it elevate us and strengthen us, but in a more orderly way. I didn't do this in person, so I hope I'm making sense. I hope that you're following me. So this is the same thing we find with food, or by extension, any physical engagement. Food is from the lower part of creation. We are taught Kabbalistically that the human being is the symbol of the word of the world of Tikkun. The human being is the symbol of the world of order. Okay? But it's... And that's great. And that's the purpose of creation. But in the lower forms, the younger forms, let's say, the lower forms of creation, the inanimate, the animalistic, the vegetation, there is where we have these sparks of intense energy which comes from the world of chaos. As to use the terminology of Kabbalah, those sparks are captured, so to speak. They were absorbed and captured in the lower forms of existence. And they present an amazing opportunity for the human being, which comes from the world of order. It's like an adult connecting with a child. The adult cannot, in other words, an adult cannot connect with a child and just remain a mature, cold adult. The adult can connect with a child but become childlike and silly. Hopefully it doesn't happen. Or an adult can connect with a child and absorb the childlike energy and become and absorb it into the world of order, and the world of order becomes that much more stronger and more powerful. So in terms of our godly connection, the same thing happens. The more intense sparks of godliness, we are taught, is found specifically in food. These are called in Kabbalah, they are called the nitzotzot, sparks. Sparks of the divine. The more powerful sparks, the more energetic sparks, are found specifically in the physical. In food, for example, if that's a typical example. But these sparks, although they are expressed in a very lower form of existence, they actually, just like the child, who's the younger one, the child, has in it this unbelievable intense power from the world of chaos, so too in the lower forms of existence, like food, food contains these sparks of godliness which actually emanate from a higher godly source that emanates from the world of chaos. Very powerful sparks. But they are captured there. They're not revealed there. Captured means they're not expressed. You don't see anything godly about a chocolate cake. You don't see anything godly about a piece of meat or vegetables. I mean, they're important. They're healthy, perhaps. Some of them are healthy, some of them are unhealthy. But you don't see anything godly, right? It seems much more godly when you land up in shul on Yom Kippur. There's nothing godly or apparently godly about a piece of food that we eat. That is because it contains sparks which are even more godly, but it's hidden, it's captured within that food. You don't see the obvious godliness of the piece of cake or the piece of fruit or the piece of meat or the piece of fish. But it's the human being's job, it's the human being's mission to specifically engage in the world of the physical, including food, and release, so to speak, and elevate those sparks. We can use the maturity, the strength, the order, the power of the world of tikkun to release those sparks in an orderly fashion. Very powerful sparks. And what happens when we do that is one of two things. One of two things. Either, if we don't do it correctly, if we do it for the wrong reasons, if we do it only for indulgence, or pursuit of pleasure in a purposeless way, in an empty way, then instead of elevating the food and instead of elevating the godly sparks that are in it, and that being very beneficial for our own and our own progress, and it's spiritually sustaining us, we are in fact drawn down. The power is like that electrical machine that is used incorrectly. It draws us down and spiritually damages us rather than elevates us. However, if we connect to the food, if we connect to eating, I'm sharing with you this Kabbalistic idea now. If we connect to the food in the right way, and we do it for the right reasons, with the right focus, in the right pathway, in the right system, then what we're doing is we are taking those powerful sparks, making them more godly. Because eating in the right way means eating for a godly purpose, eating for a godly direction. Then what happens is those sparks are released, they're revealed, they become absorbed into the world of order, and they elevate the world of order. So they elevate the human being. So yes, God designed us to eat from a world which is lower than us. That's because, says the Torah, it's not on the bread alone that you are sustained. It's because of the sparks that are in that food, the nitzotzot that are in that food, which come from a higher source, a greater source, a more intense godly source that you're supposed to connect to. And those sparks, when you connect them, you're revealing godliness in the world, you're elevating the world, but you're elevating yourself also, and you're becoming spiritually stronger and more mature and greater and more connected to God through that. So therefore, to facilitate that process, God created, He designed the human being, that it's impossible for us to exist unless we eat. The Baal Shem Tov said an amazing thing. Baal Shem Tov interpreted a verse in the Torah, in Tehillim, in Psalms, where it's a chapter of Psalms where King David is describing people who go through challenges and then they're saved, and they need to remember to thank God for the salvation, and so on and so forth. And one of those people is people who travel in a desert and run out of food, and then they are hungry, and then God shows them the way and delivers them, and they need to thank God. But when King David in Tehillim describes the hunger, he uses the following words. He says, "Reva'im gam tzme'im," these people are hungry and thirsty. "Nafsham bahem titataf," their soul is enmeshed, embedded in the hunger. Says Baal Shem Tov, what is that supposed to mean? What do you mean the soul is in the hunger? Hunger is a physical thing. It's a physiological thing. A person hasn't eaten for a while, God designed us that so we shouldn't forget to eat, I guess. That when we don't eat for a long time, we don't drink, we become hungry, we become thirsty. So that we should know to eat. Right? That's a simple explanation. So what's the soul got to do with that hunger, said the Baal Shem Tov? That no. When we become hungry, it's a soul hunger, which means, look at this. The way it works is that we need to engage with the physical to release those sparks, to elevate those hidden and captured sparks of godliness which come from that powerful world of chaos, the powerful world of Tohu. But you cannot release those sparks unless you engage with the food. So what does God do? The soul of the human being wishes to connect to the sparks of the that's contained within the physical food. So we have a soul. Our soul comes from the world of order. It's a mature soul. It's a soul of thinking. It's a godly soul. But the soul wants to now do its job. It wants to fulfill its mission, its purpose. The purpose of the soul is to live a life of meaning and purpose, specifically in the physical world. Why? Because when we find purpose within the physical, rather than just remaining within the world of the spiritual, then we're actually able to connect to that greater and deeper, loftier divine energy that's found in those sparks which are captured within the physical world. And when we release them, we're releasing a greater divine energy into the universe, and we're also absorbing that energy, elevating ourselves as well in the process. But in order to reach those sparks, we have to eat. We have to engage with the physical. So the soul wishing to connect with those sparks, our soul, wishing to connect to those divine sparks, but cannot do it unless we actually eat, triggers a hunger, a physical hunger within us. So when we're hungry to eat an apple, says the Baal Shem Tov, on the surface it's a physical desire to eat an apple. Deeper, it's the soul triggering a hunger, a physical hunger, for us to eat the apple, to connect to those divine sparks which are found within the apple. However, once the physical hunger is triggered, it's now over to us. It's over to us whether it's going to be a constructive process, whether it's going to be spiritually beneficial to us, or it's going to be spiritually not going to be spiritually beneficial, perhaps even spiritually damaging, in addition to physically damaging. So in other words, it's got to do with our own reflection. When we understand this idea, that in order to, that our physical hunger is actually triggered by a spiritual hunger to connect to the deeper level of godliness and the more intense godly spark that is found within the food, then we reflect on how we're going to absorb that energy, how are we going to become more godly by eating the food? Or are we not going to be? Are we going to be drawn down by the eating process, some spiritually and sometimes even physically if it's unhealthy? Or are we going to be elevated by the food that we eat? And the answer is, it's our choice. And this is part of the Kabbalah of eating. We actually have to think about this, and we have to train ourselves, perhaps, to eat with meaning. And eating with meaning means a number of things. It means eating for a purpose, not just for indulgence, not just for pleasure. Now, by the way, there's nothing wrong in having some form of pleasure, as long as it's not our pursuit and it's not our main purpose. But even when we talk about pleasure, and the Talmud talks about deriving pleasure from eating, it's about a consciousness of deriving pleasure from God's world. God encourages us that, especially on certain times. For example, like Shabbat, we're supposed to eat nice foods. But it's also supposed to be with a consciousness and a reminder of who created that wide range of pleasures in the world. Which is why we make blessings of God creating the fruit and the vegetables, right? So it's that consciousness of who created the food, knowing when we eat where the food comes from, and also remembering why we engage in the physical. And what it's explained in the books of Kabbalah is that eating with purpose also means not just to eat for pleasure, but to eat in order to utilize the sustenance which we have from the food to be able to serve God in a better and stronger way. So to be healthy, so we can live a life of meaning and purpose. To be able to be sustained and exist, so we should be able to, with the power and the sustenance and the energy which we absorb from the food, to be able to do another mitzvah, to be able to learn more Torah, to be able to do kindness with others, to have the strength to do that. That's what we call in the classics, eating l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. Or we eat food to fulfill a mitzvah like on Shabbos. Or we eat food to fulfill a mitzvah like Pesach. But that takes a lot of thinking, a lot of mindful focus of why we're eating. It also includes the concept, and we need to share this. This is part of the process of eating for spiritual benefit. It also involves the process of kashrut. Now, kashrut is one of those mitzvot. One of those mitzvot for which we don't know the exact reason. We don't know why some things are kosher and some things aren't kosher. Why God encouraged us to eat certain things but prohibited us from eating other things. We don't know the reason. It belongs to the category of mitzvot which we call chukim. Chukim means mitzvot which we do because God told us to. But what Kabbalah does explain is, in the context of this idea, is that those things that are permitted by God, things that are permitted is because we are able to elevate, and we're able to connect to the sparks. In other words, like this. Going back to this process that everything physical has these divine sparks that are captured within it. And by us using it in the right way, we can elevate those sparks and release those sparks and absorb them into our world and become elevated and spiritually stronger. Which is not only food, by the way, it's everything physical. So for example, the same thing happens. It's a process with everything. The same thing happens when we take a piece of parchment and we turn it into a mezuzah or a piece of tefillin or a candle and we turn it into a Shabbat candle, or we use the money and resources that we have to be kind to others and give tzedakah and so on and so forth. All of that is a process kabbalistically of birur and its sort. We're elevating each piece of the physical, we're elevating the animal, we're elevating the physicality, we're releasing those sparks, we're connecting to a greater, we're revealing and connecting to a greater and more intense level of godliness. But then we know there are certain things that we are allowed to do, certain things we're not allowed to do. Certain things we're allowed to eat and certain things we're not supposed to eat. And the way Kabbalah explains it is that the things we're allowed to do, and the same thing in the world, the other area of Kedusha, of holiness, which the Torah talks about, which is the area of sexuality, which we know, although it's probably the most physical thing that we experience, it's also the most holy thing we experience. Because again, the more physical something is, the more power it has. And we know that when two people marry, it's called kiddushin, it's holiness, it's sanctity. But then there's certain activities which God prohibited us. He asked us to do it in a particular way, and He asked us to do it only with certain people, and so on and so forth. Right? Why? So Kabbalah explains, because when we talk about the physical containing sparks of the divine, there's different levels of concealment. In other words, certain physical activities and experiences and objects in this world contain these divine sparks in a hidden way, but in a hidden way where it's possible to release them and to reveal them and to expose them and to elevate them. And then there are certain areas of the physical experience of the world, or the physical journey of the world, where the sparks fell so deep and are so hidden and are so locked that the human being does not possess the power to release those sparks. Which of course begs another question, which is a whole other discussion. And that's the case, what's the purpose of those things? What's the purpose of an animal, for example, that we're not allowed to eat if we can't release the divine sparks that are within them? What's the purpose of them then? Okay, that's another discussion. There will be a purpose, and ultimately when Mashiach comes, everything will be elevated. But for now, there are certain things we stay away from because we're not able to connect, we're not able to release those sparks and elevate it. And therefore, by engaging it, it draws us down rather than elevating us. So that's why kashrut is part of this journey. So therefore, we talk about the Kabbalah of food, the Kabbalah of eating. You know, in modern day mindfulness, there's a lot of discussion on eating mindfully. Now, eating mindfully just means to pay attention to being in the moment, to feel the taste of what you're eating, and so on and so forth. But in Jewish mindfulness, the way I always like to call it, we're not only in the moment, we're not only present in the physical, superficial form of the experience, but more present in the soul of what's going on. Eating mindfully is a huge thing. Not that we always do it, and we should work more at it. But it's eating with a focus. And it is true. In other words, it is true that when we eat something, we're able to elevate it. But it's also true that in order to do that, it means really eating with a certain focus and a certain paying attention. And what that looks like is, first of all, to stop and think, what are we eating? Why are we eating it? Who created the food? I see there's a question in the chat, which I'm going to get to in a moment. Who created the food? Which is the idea of a bracha. One of the most amazing mindful ways of eating is the concept of making a blessing. Now, unfortunately, even those who are accustomed to making blessings every time they eat, but we become so accustomed to it, become so used to it, it's possible just to do it in a very non-mindful way. So we pick up something to eat and we just mumble off a blessing. Of course, that's not the purpose. The purpose is to do it mindfully. A blessing is the most amazing. A blessing over food. Every food has its own blessing. There are laws of which blessing applies to which food. It's an incredibly divine mindfulness exercise where we stop. We don't just grab the food. We stop before we eat. And we think to ourselves, hold on a second. Who is this food from? Who gave it to us? Who allowed us to partake in it? Baruch Ata Hashem. We bless God, our God, the King of the universe, acknowledging that He is the source of all good, acknowledging He is the source of all blessing. Borei Pri Eitz, He's the one that created this fruit. He's the one that created the bread, He's the one that created the fish, and so on and so forth. That's the first part of eating with a focus. The making of the blessing before we eat is part of the ability that gives us to eat with a focus, elevating the food. Also, what we eat. We eat things that are able to be elevated. That's why kashrut plays such an important role in this journey of birur hanitzitzot, of clarifying and elevating the sparks. And then, of course, is how we eat. What are we eating for? Are we eating just to enjoy life? Are we eating just to get stuck in and indulge and fill ourselves with things which are in excess or perhaps very unhealthy? Or are we eating for a purpose? Are we eating for a mitzvah? Are we eating because there's a higher purpose to eating? There's an importance of being healthy and sustaining ourselves so we should be able to serve God better. There's an importance of eating so we should be able to elevate those sparks and become connected with a higher and more intense level of divine energy. And that's an important thought process to go to. You know, there's a story of the Baal Shem Tov, because it's not always so easy. You know, even when eating is a mitzvah, right? For example, on Shabbat, we can be eating kosher, we can be eating the right things, and it's a mitzvah on Shabbat to enjoy the Shabbat, of course. So definitely there is a mitzvah to eat a bit more on Shabbat than during the week, that's all true. But yet, it doesn't mean that if we do it, we're naturally doing it for the mitzvah. They tell a story, you know, the Hasidim, the other Hasidic groups, they wear something on the head called shtreimel. Shtreimel is like a fur sort of hat, and it's like, you know, It's an image of a Hasidic Jew wearing a shtreimel. So the Baal Shem Tov once called over his disciples. He looked through the window and he says, "Come, I want to show you an ox with a shtreimel eating cholent." So his students were a bit surprised. Where do you get a shtreimel on top of an ox? And saying, "Well, why would an ox with a shtreimel anyway be eating cholent?" Until they realized the Baal Shem Tov is not talking about the animal, the ox, is talking about a human being who's eating and stuffing himself on Shabbos, supposedly for the mitzvah, and yet just an animal with a shtreimel eating cholent. Because lost the reason of why. Why are we doing it? Why are we eating? So yes, the bracha is really important. What we eat in terms of kashrut and health is also important, very important. Because that gives us the ability to elevate. But it's also why we're eating. In terms of our level of indulgence and the level of self-control, and so on and so forth. That's also important. So just because we're making a blessing, just because we're eating Shabbos food, that we haven't yet checked off the entire list of the tools that we need to elevate the food. And this goes back to the famous passage of Nachmanides, the Ramban, where the Ramban said, and I'll end with this and then we can take some questions, where the Ramban said on the verse, the famous verse in the Torah, where the Torah asks us, he asks us to be holy. It says, Kedoshim tihiyu. You shall be holy. There's a mitzvah to be holy. And again, when it talks about holiness, it's normally in the physical. And the Ramban says, what does it mean to be holy? What kind of mitzvah is it to be holy? What does that mean? And the famous comment of the Nachmanides is as follows. He says, the Torah is talking about sanctifying even that which is permitted. In other words, yes, of course, in order to elevate the sparks of a food, for example, it needs to be with a blessing, it needs to be kosher, and so on. But that doesn't, you haven't finished the requirements yet. Because says the Ramban, it is possible for, you won't find holiness unless you go to one other thing. And the Ramban says, Nachmanides says, that a person can be what he calls a naval birashut ha-Torah. He can be a low life with God's permission. Meaning, he says, I'm eating kosher. It's all kosher. I'm making a blessing. It's Jewish food. It's all good. Yes, but you're eating it like an indulgent animal. So that's not holiness. So therefore, the third step is, yes, we need the bracha, we need it to be kosher, but we also need it to be eaten properly. Which is a very important lesson nowadays in the world of materialism where, you know, it's kosher is one requirement, but then it's also a requirement to be refined, to eat with a focus, to exercise some degree of self-control and to eat for the right reason. And that's what he says, that's what the Torah means, Kedoshim, you should be holy. Which means even when you do something that is permitted, you're making a bracha, you're eating kosher, but still you have to do it for the right reason, it has to be for the right focus, the right preparation, the right reflection, the right meditation before you start. And that's Kedoshim, that's how you find the level of holiness. Before we finish out, let me just... Yeah, very good question. So the question was about the concept of elevation. One second here, So the question was, are us as Jewish humans part of our own elevation, of our own vessel? For example, if I'm able to change a bad midah, like a bad personality trait, is this considered a raising of the sparks too? Yes, so the answer is that it is. And of course, we elevate ourselves by working on our own personality. But still, God expects us to engage in the physical to get even a deeper level, which includes our personality, because we have to have self-control, not be indulgent, and eat for the right reason. That's also part of our own personality training. But we do actually have to engage with the... That's what's unique about Yiddishkeit. I mean, even... I'll give you an example. A person can sit down at the Seder table on Pesach night. I don't mean to scare anyone that Pesach's around the corner, but it is, right? So, on Pesach night, we have a Seder, right? And there's a mitzvah to eat matzah, and matzah has all kinds of reflections and all kinds of deep insights, which are amazing, in terms of humility and loss of ego and all kinds of amazing things. But if someone will sit down at the Seder table, for example, and meditate and really delve into the deep insights of matzah, but not actually eat the matzah, they haven't done the mitzvah, and they haven't accessed that degree of elevation which is only accessible in the food. That spark is only accessible in the food. Might become a more refined person, yes, there's a certain elevation, but hasn't accessed the power within the matzah, right? Which is why in Judaism, the goal is not spirituality. We need spirituality as part of the preparation. The goal is the physical. I'll just end off with this idea. We're coming soon to Purim. Purim is a very, very physical festival. It's all about eating and food packages and everything, right? Same idea. And the Zohar says that Purim is even greater than Yom Kippur. And the reason for that is, it's a whole other discussion, but the reason for that is because on Yom Kippur, we reach a very, very high, intense level of spirituality. But there the process, and we need it, it's a critical part of the process, but there it's about disengaging with the world. We fast, we run away, we escape, we bury ourselves in the shul. It's a very spiritual experience, which is critically necessary. But it doesn't come to Purim. Purim is where we discover God in the food. With food, we engage with the physical, takes preparation. You need to have a Yom Kippur before you can get to the Purim, but Purim is the ultimate sort of connection. Just the thought on Purim, because it's around the corner. But yes, so that's why the Torah is such a religion of physical engagement. All our mitzvot are physical. It's all about elevating the physical world. So that's an introduction to the Kabbalah of food. And that's just a general principle on the focus of eating from a Kabbalistic point of view. And next week, B'ezrat Hashem, we're going to go through specific areas of food. Like what is the energy behind matzah? What's the energy behind wine on Friday night or on Purim? And a few other examples, hopefully. So for now, just wish everyone a wonderful, wonderful night. And hopefully
thank you, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rabbi.